Professor Poulet's paper is open to discussion. He has, he plans to answer questions posed in French, and questions posed in English, as long as his English stays with him, I should say.
Provided that it does not break down.
Break down, that's right. Yes. It will be a help, by the way, if people asking questions will identify themselves. There are many of our guests will not identify people here in the front of the room, and people in the back who want to ask questions will not be known.
Monsieur Poulet, je voudrais vous poser une question. Je m'excuse très très simple, comme un paysan polonais. Quelle est la différence entre le processus de lire et le processus d'entendre quelqu'un? Un autre qui parle, puisque si, d'après votre analyse, le processus de lire, c'est l'intériorisation d'un objet extérieur qui devient un objet mental, est-ce que ce n'est pas la même chose quand on entend quelqu'un qui parle? Est-ce pas possible de faire à peu près la même typologie de critique avec, c'est-à-dire de faire la même typologie des auditeurs que vous avez faite la typologie de critique? Par exemple, si dans le processus d'entendre quelqu'un qui parle, on ne peut pas limiter ou trouver un type qui reste à la surface des mots, un autre qui intériorise la biographie d'un autre, et le troisième qui le combat ou qui fait son possible pour l'objectivisation de cet objet intérieur qui était avant un objet extérieur. C'est-à-dire, si c'est vrai, alors il n'existait pas aucune différence entre le métier du critique et le métier de quelqu'un qui entend la conversation. C'est-à-dire, il n'y aurait pas une différence profonde et une différence fondamentale entre une personne qui entend et entre un liseur, entre un critique et entre un auditeur.
En effet, monsieur, la différence n'est pas fondamentale. Vous avez tout à fait raison de le faire remarquer. Elle n'est pas fondamentale et pourtant elle s'affirme, et elle s'affirme à l'instant même où la conversation s'engage. Étant donné que dans la conversation, les interlocuteurs n'ont pas seulement l'habitude de s'écouter l'un l'autre, ils ont aussi l'habitude de parler l'un et l'autre. Et quand on parle, on n'écoute pas. Et très souvent, la conversation ainsi, au lieu de devenir une interrelation dans laquelle quelqu'un qui écoute ou qui lit s'efforce de s'identifier avec la pensée de quelqu'un qui écrit ou qui parle, n'est-ce pas? Nous avons au contraire une sorte de lutte, une sorte d'opposition, une sorte de différenciation. L'acte de la lecture, tel que je le conçois, est exactement le contraire de cette différenciation. C'est avant tout une adhésion, et même une adhésion provisoirement sans réserve. Il peut se faire que progressivement par la suite, comme je l'ai marqué par exemple dans le cas de Jean Starobinski, il y ait un détachement de la part du critique qui ne se contente plus simplement d'écouter, mais qui se met à réfléchir pour son compte pendant que son interlocuteur part. Il peut y arriver à un détachement de ce genre. Mais la plupart du temps, dans l'acte critique tel que je le conçois, il y a d'abord une première partie qui est nécessairement d'adhésion absolue. Et l'adhésion absolue, vous pouvez la qualifier soit comme l'acte du lecteur ou soit comme l'acte de l'écouteur, mais pas comme une conversation.
If I may put... Well, the question was whether there was any real difference between the process of reading and the process of listening to someone who's speaking to you. I mean, very briefly, and the answer was that the difference is not fundamental. However, in reading, there is complete adhesion, an act of the reader or the locutor, which is not necessarily the same in the case of listening to conversation, because one can think while listening to the other. Is that
all right?
If I might be permitted to ask a rather simple-minded philosophical question similar to the one I asked of Mr. Morizet this afternoon, I think it might help some of us to have you comment on this, because it might make your point of view and your approach to structuralism and the study of structures somewhat more clear. Now, in listening to your very dense, I found very dense and concentrated exposition, I felt at the beginning that in a sense we were brought back almost to the Greeks with this radical opposition between subject and object and the desire to know in discerning various types of criticism whether the critic is going from the object to the subject or from the subject to the object, until we found towards the end that the proper route is to go from subject to the object. And then I thought that you illustrated this very well at the very end when you recalled your visiting the Scuola San Rocco, surrounded by all of these creations of Tintoretto, and discovering there the very essence, one might say, of the creativity of Tintoretto. Now, this seems to me to be a phenomenological discovery, and I sense, and I think I understand, that sense of a structure, of a signifié, which is transcendent to the experiencer and is experienced, not only transcendent to the experiencer, but transcendent in a sense to the creator, because it is in every one of his works, and yet it's not completely in any one of them. It's a kind of eidetic structure. Now, you emphasize the indeterminate character of this structure. It's the pure subjectivity, and you so emphasize the indeterminate character that it seemed to me that in the end, you lost all structure, you lost the structure altogether. In fact, you said that structure is the disappearance of form. And now I am lost again, completely. I can understand the eidetic structure, let's say, of the discovery of the mind of a Tintoretto. But this is not any consciousness, and it's not the disappearance of consciousness, it's the consciousness of Tintoretto. Therefore, though it is sufficiently transcendent, I can at least attempt to understand, kind of a limit idea, sufficiently transcendent that it is not incarnate completely in any one work. Nevertheless, it is the subjectivity of Tintoretto that you have discovered and not of Titian or not of something else. Therefore, it is not a lack of all determinacy or otherwise. If it is, then I would like some elucidation about what you understand structure to be and what your position is on structuralism.
Myself, so we are in the same difficulty. If I had to attempt some kind of explanation or conciliation of these different statements that I made, which risk to be contradictory, I would say that speaking of Tintoretto and of my experience in at the school of Venice, what I had clearly in my mind at the time, I am not so sure of that now, was the fact that I was somehow in possession of the essence of is it of Tintoretto? Is it of the genius of Tintoretto distinguished from Tintoretto the man? Is it of an essence which is only possible to get at when you have in mind the certain totality of the works of the same author? Probably because what becomes visible then at that particular moment, and which is usually not so clearly visible in any particular work, are a certain number of habits, of images, of characteristics of the mind, of mental themes, which to my mind are the very representation of another consciousness, which is not necessarily, I affirm, the consciousness of Tintoretto himself. When I was saying that, arriving at the essence of Tintoretto, I was using the word essence. I had somebody clearly in my mind. That somebody was Marcel Proust. Marcel Proust, in his young days, when he was translating Ruskin, a particular work of Ruskin, which was the Bible of Amiens, insisted on bringing a series of examples taken from all the other works of Ruskin in order to, he said, to make clearly appear to the reader this fidelity of the consciousness of Ruskin to particular essences, to particular themes. And for him, it seemed to be the very aim of consciousness. Now, to arrive at something which is far more important and which was included in your question, am I for or am I against structuralism? I simply do not know. And it is not for me to say so, it is for the structuralists themselves. For my own part, sometimes I feel rather alien to the abstract and to the voluntarily objective way in which these structuralists express their own discoveries. Sometimes I am even shocked by that position. Sometimes I'm shocked especially by the fact, I think particularly of one of them and whom I consider as a friend, I'm particularly shocked when they pretend to arrive, therefore, at scientific attitudes. I must confess that to my own mind and very clearly, very definitely, criticism is a kind of knowledge, but it's not a kind of scientific knowledge. And I have to decline very strongly the name of scientist. I'm not a scientist, and I do not think that any true critic, when he is making an act of criticism, can be a scientist. That is very clear, and probably it puts me completely in the wrong with the structuralist. But sometimes also, very often, why should I not say their names? With Roland Barthes or with Gérard Genette, for instance, and some of the Russian structuralists, I feel a close affinity, and it seems to me that their pretension to arrive at the kind of absolute objectivity is not very far of my hope of arriving at something which I call absolute subjectivity.
This is a rather limited question, and it's to deal only with that part of your paper. I also find your paper very dense and very interesting, and I would like to read it. But to deal only with that part of your paper which considers the subjectivity, that middle part where you're talking about the identification. That was all very familiar to me, and I would like to suggest to you a model for that, and then some of the difficulties which I know from my experience with that model. Because when you suggest that the critic allows another consciousness to invade his consciousness, and when you suggest that his act is mimetic, and when you suggest an annexation, I think of an actor in possession of a play text whose whole rehearsal process is designed to do exactly what you describe, almost in those terms.
to somehow allow that text not only to enter his consciousness literally and memorize it, but to somehow find the gestures of that consciousness, to speak the voice of that consciousness, etc. So my first question, and I'll go on with an assumed answer, but if I'm wrong, I would like you to contradict me. My first question is, isn't what you described as the subjective mode of the critic somewhat like or very close to what the actor does when he is in possession of someone's text and therefore tries to appropriate the consciousness of the playwright, at least one aspect of that consciousness? Now, if it is so that this is what you describe the critic should do at that point, that phase, is close to what the actor should do, there are several difficulties. Because the actor, even after weeks and months of work of appropriating this consciousness, never really appropriates it, never really enters into anything that is truly subjective. At best, he is able to imitate certain gestures. At best, he is able to somehow tune his mind into certain gestures and rhythms. But I think it's a mistake if you, when you ended your answer to the last question of an absolute subjectivity, to think that one has approached an objective subjectivity. In other words, one has approached the consciousness of the author. It is true that the author grasps the mind, but I don't think that it's true that the resultant consciousness in the critic or in the actor is the consciousness that the author might have intended or might even be there in the work. Well, let me stop there, because I think I'll have some later questions, but I really think that there's a difficulty involved in your basic structure there.
Well, the sort of question that you ask me is very bad. I mean, very bad for me, because it exposed my essential weakness. My essential weakness is my near incapability of going to a theater and to look or listen to a play. That seems to be a spectacle absolutely unbearable, insufferable. I cannot do it. I never do it. The only possibility for me when I have to tackle with a play is to read it. That's what I did, and there I have no difficulty whatever, you see.
I'm not unaware of the hands in the back of the room, and I shouldn't wish to give proximity priority over distance here, though Professor Singleton has something to say, and after he's asked his question, we can move back to the back of the room.
Has seized the microphone, which was close at hand. Two before me have told our speaker that he was very dense. I find the contrary, that he was so lucid that he tended to disappear from this room as I followed his thought, and he became part of me. And this was quite an experience. But it isn't that that I want to talk about. I want to speak before the structuralists move in on you. I want to think that you had an experience in the Scuola di San Rocco that is ordinarily called mystical, that it quite transcends all sensible objects, and I'm not sure that anyone can follow you there any more than, well, I won't mention that poem again that we were talking about this afternoon, but it does seem to me that there is a touch in your finale, which Christian theology does talk about in other terms, and I'm not preaching, I'm just observing. But I want to ask the diabolical question, being, as I said, a lost man myself, and turn the screw just one more turn to see what you would do with the author or creator as reader of his own creation. What happens then that you can imagine happened.
I'm trying to find
a now, if the intentional power beyond the object, coming through the object to your je, if you are replaced in that situation by the author of the object, what must we think the author as reader experiences?
Is your question relative to the intentionality of the author himself? Or to something else.
But now his intentionality, is objectified in this work in such a way that you, not the author, but the reader, can be in communication with it, and we follow you there. Now replace that I with the author I.
I would not replace the I within the work by an I which would be outside the work. And if we put the name of Dante, for instance, as the name of the author in question, I would say that the only Dante with whom I would be preoccupied would be the Dante within the work, and which is and who is there in two ways. He's there as the hero of the poem, and he's there also as the very intentionality present in the poem, in such a way that it cannot be distinguished from the poem itself. I have no need for this other Dante, who it is said is the author of the Divina Commedia. It is said so, but I'm not sure of that. I'm sure that William Shakespeare has written things under that name.
I didn't mean to create a mystical or difficult situation. Let's let it be the simple act of reading on the part of an author who has just finished writing his work and is reading it over with a critical eye. Why does he change it here and there? What's he working with? An intentionality that's coming through to him, or how is this?
Let's not play on the word critical eye, and the word critical including the expression critical eye. The expression critical eye should be said uncritical eye. When the author is looking at its work in such a particular way that he wants to see the defects and to correct them, he's not making an act of criticism, he's just doing the contrary.
The identifying, testing an identification?
He has to take his distance, he has to to try, it has to continue the same act, which is the act of creation. And the act of creation is an uncleaned sort of act.
Then can he ever be reader of his own work?
Why not? Why not? When he will have forgotten that he has written it, there must be, I think, a way of perfect detachment in which the author can read his own stuff when having completely forgotten that he has written it.
This gentleman in the very back has...
I'm Henry Aiken from Brandeis.
Can I make myself heard without this thing?
No. Oh, I can. I have to use this.
Well, it's worse.
I don't mean to be outdone by my old colleague, Professor Singleton, in my admiration for the splendid paper. I shall simply say that I found the remarks about Tintoretto at the Scuola also thoroughly and sublimely luminous. I mean now to make some remarks about your dialectic, sir, and to query you about some implications of it. I want to begin by saying that I thoroughly share your feeling that the critic is not a scientist, and I hope it will be understood that the drift of my questioning is not intended to drive you, so to say, into the arms of science, though there are worse arms, I suppose. I want rather to suggest that you drew a set of distinctions in a way that it seemed to me not fully lucid. Let me begin in the following way. You began by distinguishing between work of art, I suppose it was that we were talking about, and an object, the one there for all time and not to be transgressed, I think was your phrase, by ourselves, and then the work, at any rate, of literary art. The contrast being suggested that one was transgressible and the other was not. Then, unfortunately, you brought up the sewing machine, as I remember, and the sewing machine was identified now with an object as something which reveals itself, I take it, once for all, subject to the interior transgressions of the critic. But at this point, I began to fidget, for it seemed to me that there was, in some sense, something that the artifact, the sewing machine, and the poem shared in common that distinguished them from the physical object, that both were in some sense products of the mind, and both were identifiable by intentions other than those that are employed in the identification of physical objects. It seemed to me, therefore, if you will understand me, that your distinction between the artifact and the work of art was not a hard distinction, or you hadn't made it hard. But then as we went along, I saw you, as I saw your dialectic developing, it seemed to me perfectly plain that you were making now, quite properly, and I thoroughly applauded, a distinction now between the work of art and my impression of the work of art, between the work of art and something that I impute to it or impose upon it. And it became gradually apparent to me that the transgressions which you forbade us in talking about the physical work also could be applied now to the work of art itself. And then it dawned on me, or seemed to, that the appearance-reality distinctions that you were now beginning to draw were applicable indeed to all of these things, to object, to artifact, and to work of art. That further, that the indeterminacy that you properly ascribed to the work of art could also indeed be applied to the physical object, and perhaps also, though I haven't quite thought this through, to the artifact too. And so it seemed to me that though I was following and applauding, I found that in the end, that though I thought I agreed with your dialectic in a way, I found that in the end you had left me unclear as to the distinction now between the work of art with its interiority, the artifact with its, and now, so help me, the object also, if you follow me, with its. Correspondingly, I didn't find myself clear about the objective difference between the physical object, the artifact, and the work of art. And so what I conclude is that much as I admired the development of your remarks when you finally approached criticism itself, I found that the idea of the work of art, or of the critical object, shall I say, had not been sufficiently differentiated yet from the artifact on the one side and from the physical object on the other, so that you hadn't quite earned the right, if I can put it this way, to your splendid remark that the critic is not a scientist. Do you understand what I'm suggesting?
All right, sir. You are quite right about the sewing machine. The sewing machine is something very dangerous. I should never have used it. I should have left it completely alone. But I used the sewing machine just as I would have used, for instance, I do not know, a stone or a root of a chestnut tree, just as Sartre used in La Nausée, you remember. That is to say that for me, at the moment and that I used that unfortunate sewing machine, I was considering in it not at all the artifact that undoubtedly it is, but simply that kind of rather stupid way that sewing machine have to be there before you and that you can just simply helpless with them, especially myself. But it is perfectly true that there is some sort of connection between a sewing machine and a work of art, since in both cases we find the agency of man. I do not like at all the expression work of art. I detest it and usually avoid it. I don't think that once in the text I read before you, I used the expression work of art. I used very often the expression a mental work or a mental object by contradistinction with that kind of external object which can be a sewing machine. But I freely confess that in a sewing machine we can obviously see the intervention of man, and these interventions can be constructed in a relationship within the object, a relationship which is of cause and of cause and effect. The sewing machine is created by man, and I consider the sewing machine as this creation. We can also consider another kind of cause, which is the final cause. The sewing machine has been created in order to sew. All right. But that seems to me extremely different from what is that mental work in with whom I find myself suddenly in that odd kind of communication which I try to describe under the name of reading. There, the category of cause and effect, even the theological idea of cause seems to me profoundly secondary. And what is extraordinarily important is simply the presence in an object of something which is not objective, and something which of which I cannot find at all an example in the sewing machine.
Mr. Girard has a question, and then Mr. Goldman.
I would like to ask a question about what Professor Poulet seems to assume to be the archetypal act of reading, which is identification to the author. And this is what I would question. I think that the archetypal act of reading can sometimes be identification to the author, but in most instances, the act of reading, which is essential, is one of fascination, I would say. And I'm not the one who says this. I feel all the great writers have been preoccupied with these problems. I mean, we can begin very far. Paolo and Francesca, for instance, in Dante, are not interested in the author of Lancelot. They are not identifying with the author, but they are identifying with the characters. The Cervantes at the theater is not identifying with the author of the play, since he's fighting the puppets, he mistakes them for real being. We have the same problem again in Madame Bovary, and in many poets, I would think of the prose. Pour des essaims, I would think, of course, of Proust and the theater posters, and the latest example, I think, which goes back to this problematic, would be of Sartre and Les Mots. In each case, the writer is terribly preoccupied with the fact that reading is essentially, in a way, a loss, a dispossession of the individual who becomes, in a way, possessed not by an author, not identifying with another consciousness, but fascinated by a text, whatever the text means there. And in the case of the novel, it seems to me that the itinerary of the hero is always a shift from this fascination to a realization that the printed text, the work, is really a human act, a human action among others, which may be replaced. In other words, a victory over this fascination. I would say the work is very ambiguous. A man like Cervantes is fully aware that a book written against the fascination of book will become itself fascinating. And Don Quixote, in the second part of the novel, goes around with his book in his hand, and Cervantes himself predicts the wrong interpretations, the identifications with his hero, which the future will see. But essentially, I feel the critical act cannot be immediate. It has to be mediate. It has to be the opposite of this fascination, and it has to recover the situation of the work of art, or rather it has to span, I would say, the whole distance between this fascination and this opposite, which would call explication. And it seems to me, of course, that all this implies an infinitely more complex relationship between the self and the other, the reader and the author, than the one we have in this dialectics.
Thank you.
May I answer you in French? When Anglo-Saxon people ask me questions in English, I find that definitely just. But when a French person asks me a question in English and asks me to answer in English, I find that definitely unfair. Mon cher Girard, je retrouve bien dans votre question vos préoccupations essentielles qui sont d'une très grande importance, qui m'ont appris beaucoup de choses et contre lesquelles, cependant, vous savez que je me suis défendu moi-même avec une certaine énergie. Cela est vrai, je le dis avec une certaine reluctance, je fais du franglais maintenant, je le dis avec une certaine résistance, cela est vrai dans l'acte de la lecture, il peut y avoir une sorte de déviation, peut-être accepterez-vous ce terme, je crois qu'il est juste, une sorte de déviation qui se trouve d'ailleurs provoquée dans la lecture par le livre, ou en tout cas par une partie même du livre, car dans l'épisode même que vous me donnez, qui est un épisode essentiel, l'épisode de Paolo et Francesca, d'un côté, il s'agit d'un certain livre qui est lu par certains personnages, mais d'un autre côté, le livre dont il s'agit, c'est bien sûr la Divine Comédie elle-même. Il y a la Divine Comédie, il y a l'intérieur de la Divine Comédie, il y a une partie du livre en quelque sorte qui se détache pour le faire dévier, et qui en forme véritablement comme la caricature ou comme le contraire. C'est là, en effet, quelque chose que vous nous avez appris à voir dans la littérature, et je suis tout à fait d'accord avec vous. L'acte de la lecture, ce n'est pas simplement l'identification innocente, ou en tout cas simpliste, que je proposais à première vue, mais c'est quelque chose d'infiniment plus complexe. C'est le mot même que vous avez prononcé. Je crois donc que sur tous les points, nous sommes d'accord, sinon peut-être sur un seul, c'est que cette activité secondaire cette intervention de quelque chose qui se situe entre le moi et l'autre, ce second autre par rapport au premier, qui produit donc la relation triangulaire dont vous êtes en quelque sorte, au point de vue critique, le roi, doit le céder, je crois, en fin de compte, à la dualité et même à l'unité d'une fusion. Il est vrai qu'il y a, j'emploie un mot que j'avais employé dans ma correspondance avec vous, il est vrai qu'il y a un côté mesquin dans l'acte d'écrire et qui se reproduira avec la même mesquinerie dans l'acte de lire. Mais il est vrai aussi que nous pouvons dépasser ce stade et qu'il y a un moment alors, un moment où nous sommes en pleine fusion, où il n'y a plus trois, où il n'y a plus deux, où il n'y a qu'un.
My dear Girard, your essential preoccupations against which I have defended myself with a certain energy, I agree with them, and it's true in the act of reading. There may be a kind of deviation provoked by the book, or at least a part of the book, like the story of Paolo and Francesca on the one side. The book they're dealing with is the Divine Comedy, and inside the Divine Comedy there's that part which is detached from it and which serves as a caricature of the whole work. But I agree also that the act of reading is not simply an innocent identification, but an infinitely more complex process. We agree on all points, except one perhaps, that secondary intervention between me and the other, your business of the triangle, must... of which you are king, must give way to a duality and even to the unity of a fusion between the author and the reader.
Sir Goldman.
Oui. C'est pour comprendre la position de Poulet que je voulais lui poser une question. C'est très clair qu'entre les positions scientifiques que j'essaie de défendre et ce que vous avez appelé ne pas être une science, nous situons sur des plans différents. C'est pas là que je veux, sur ce plan que je veux discuter. Mais vous avez défini votre position tout de même comme une connaissance qui ne serait pas science, si je ne me trompe pas, non ? Ou un savoir qui ne serait pas science. Je vois très bien ce que cette activité, ce type d'activité que vous avez si magistralement développé ici et que vous avez indiqué chez une série d'autres critiques sur des modalités diverses, peut apporter à la vie culturelle. Ça ne se situe pas sur le plan scientifique, vous le dites vous-même. Mais alors, quel est le critère, je dirais, de la falsification de cette connaissance ? C'est-à-dire, pour être très simple et très naïf de l'extérieur, si un mauvais élève de Poulet va à la Scuola San Rocco, a l'impression de s'identifier et de trouver une essence de Tintoretto, mais se trompe. Comment est-ce qu'on peut, dans quel cas peut-on savoir qu'il s'est trompé, et dans quel cas cette identification a une valeur créative, critique, telle que vous le réalisez si magistralement et telle que vous l'apprenez. Ça m'indiquerait la réponse, si parfois elle est difficile, par exemple, quand est-ce qu'une œuvre d'art est valable ou non, mais si la réponse serait possible, ça m'éclairerait un peu mieux sur le statut même de cette activité critique.
You have defined your position as a knowledge which wouldn't be a science, I don't disagree with that, but what's the criterion of the falsification of this knowledge? If we take a bad pupil looking at the Tintoretto and finding the wrong essence, how can you tell he's wrong? And what's the value of criticism?
Que fera Poulet avec le mauvais élève de Poulet? En réalité, je tâcherai de faire ce que je fais avec tout écrivain, ou avec Tintoretto dans le cas de l'œuvre d'art, je tâcherai de m'identifier avec mon mauvais élève. Et je ne pourrai pas le faire, je ne pourrai pas y réussir. Le seul critère donc que j'aurai du fait que l'élève de Poulet est un mauvais élève de Poulet consisterait dans le fait que Poulet ne peut pas s'identifier avec cet élève.
What will Poulet do with the With Poulet's poor student. And Goldman, no, how will he know that it's a poor student? Well, I'll have to identify myself with a poor student, which is practically impossible. And precisely the criterion that the student is a poor student is that I, Poulet, cannot identify with him.
Mr. Miel, there, the red beard, has a question. Here, right behind you. We'll, excuse me, perhaps two or three more questions will be enough. Is that...
Yes, please. Jan Miel, Wesleyan University. I'd like to answer a question rather than ask one, if I may. I'd like to return to Professor Singleton's question about the author reading himself. And I think there's a very valid answer to that question, which was not exactly given. And that is, between the author writing his work and the author reading his work, even immediately afterwards, and perhaps for the purpose of correcting his own work, something has intervened, and although I hesitate to say it, c'est le temps humain. Now, the passage of time between these two acts clearly poses a problem of the identity of the subject through time. The author who reads his own work has passed through this intervening time, and is an important question posed as to whether the jeu of the author est un autre au moment après. I think this is an important question because I would see implied in your own manner of criticism that the conscience, or consciousness rather, of the author is total through all his works, in spite of the fact that his consciousness has in fact crossed a considerable stretch of time in many cases from the works of his youth to the works of his old age.
Yes, there is a problem there, rather important problem. Considering the problem of reading oneself, we could think of Sartre, and of what Sartre said. You remember that Sartre said, I think it was somewhere in L'être et le néant, that as soon as the work was finished, the work becomes a kind of en-soi. It's not a part of the pour-soi of the artist. Therefore, it becomes something objective with whom the author has not anymore the close connection that he had for a time. And therefore, the conclusion of such things would be the fact that as soon as an author has finished with a work, the only thing that he can do is to start another one. There is no possibility of re-establishing himself in a true, authentic relationship with his own work as soon as the work is finished. That's the position of Sartre. It would not certainly be my own. I would say rather the opposite. I would say that the only possibility for an author to establish oneself in an authentic relationship with the work is precisely when that work being finished and at the same time the concentration, the intentional concentration with which the author has continuously gone at his work, tried to realize it, having stopped, then there is a possibility for the author to look at his work in a purely detached way. Purely detached, but by detached I mean in a complete relaxation of mind, but at the same time, it may be with an extreme lucidity, in such a way that it may be only at that moment that he can attain at complete knowledge of what he has done. That reminds me of a marvelous anecdote which I found in the at the American edition of the works of De Quincey, when De Quincey relates that at the time of the French Revolution, being with Wordsworth somewhere in the Lake District, I think it was in Keswick, both of them went up the road which goes to Penrith in order to have a little earlier, to meet a little earlier the mail post, and therefore having news of the war. And neither of them hearing anything at all, Wordsworth put his ear against the ground and listens intently. And then suddenly, De Quincey says, I looked at his face and I saw his face changing. And Wordsworth explained afterwards that his face had been changing because at the very moment when he relaxed, when he didn't concentrate himself on the listening to the noise of the wheels coming along the road, at this moment he had a new and marvelous views of the mountains around Keswick. Well, that new and marvelous view of one's own work is the same sort of thing.
And we have one more question, Mr. Holland.
Monsieur Poussin. This one. Then I can go back here. I would like to introduce into all this Gallic logic and lucidity something dark and murky from psychoanalysis. I'm a psychoanalytic critic. And I find that most of my colleagues who are literary critics are unfamiliar with a very interesting experiment, which was performed 22 years ago, which bears on precisely this issue. It's called the Heider-Simmel experiment, so-called because it was performed by a gentleman named Heider and a lady named Simmel. It bears precisely on the point we are discussing, and it seems to me produces a kind of empirical confirmation and perhaps slight correction of your point. This was performed at Smith College. And what they did was they showed the Smith girls an animated cartoon detailing the adventures of a large black triangle, a small black triangle, a small circle, going into and out of a rectangle. Now, after seeing the movie, the Smith girls were asked to comment in various ways upon it, and they concluded that the larger triangle was pugnacious, was ill-tempered, was belligerent, and indeed 8% of the Smith girls concluded that the larger triangle had a lower IQ than the smaller triangle. Now, the point of all this is that when we create characters, as Monsieur Girard says, or when we identify with a work, as you say, it seems to me we are creating this from ourselves. The work gives us something to create with, but it is not nearly so active as you, I think, imply. And you also call it an I, a self, a subject, which again seems to me to suggest more activity than the experiment would indicate. Again, if I may introduce another empirical version of this, is hypnosis, which is very like our relationship with the work of literature, and some very interesting work has been done on hypnosis recently. But the point would be that in hypnosis, the subject, excuse me, I better not use that word, the hypnotizand feels the personality of the hypnotist as though it is a part of himself. And he does not feel it as alien, but rather when the hypnotist says, your hand feels cold, your hand does feel cold, which I think is rather like the way we respond to a book. And from this come some conclusions that the term identification, with all its implications of subject and object, is much more further along the developmental line than the psychoanalyst's term for our relationship with the book. The psychoanalyst would speak, I think, of incorporation, which is a much more primitive kind of mechanism, in fact, related basically, ultimately, to eating. As, for example, when we speak of a man as a voracious reader. And the implication, I think, is that we can devour books, but not sewing machines. Well, what I wanted to suggest ultimately, then, is a kind of correction that I am not sure that to call the other, the book, to call it an I, having an impact on a passive or relatively passive me, is an accurate description of what precisely, I think, goes on. There are many other models in this area that psychoanalysis would indicate. The model of the actor is an extremely interesting one in this case because his situation is very similar to that of the reader. But also the relationship of the mother and the child is another one. And the relationship of two lovers. If you would care to explore this further, not the lovers, I was thinking of, but the whole general topic, the opening chapter of Civilization and Its Discontents describes this whole, a great many things which bear on this relationship. That's where Freud talks about the oceanic experience, you may remember. But anyway, it is in many ways a relationship like a relationship between two lovers, which would get us into the other problem, namely how much to think when you're reading a book. And I take it is like being in love. It's not good to think too much, and it's not good not to think at all.
Yes. First of all, about the experiment, the Ayer Simpson experiment, isn't it? Considering that it is about triangles, and that Professor Girard is a specialist of triangles, perhaps I could suggest that he would answer instead of me on this particular point. But putting this joke apart, to excuse myself of such an easy joke, I want to consider very seriously what you told me. What troubles me much is the fact that in psychoanalysis you can find some kind of incorporation of, you say, identification in more than one example, and in particular in the case of the identification of the patient with the doctor. Is there some kind of similarity between this kind of identification and the identification I was speaking of? Probably at a certain level it is true, but at the level at which I want to very carefully to place myself, I do not see any resemblance proper, considering that in the case of the psychoanalytical identification, the identification, the best part at least of the identification is made at the subconscious level, at the subconscious level. What I was speaking of in the act of reading is something which is done at the fully conscious level. By fully conscious, I do not mean that at any moment when we read, we are in a kind of absolutely clear consciousness, but there are a certain number of levels even in clear consciousness, and it may be that in reading we are plunged in a kind of confused consciousness, a sort of cloudy kind of consciousness, but which is definitely not the subconscious proper. There I see a difficulty which is to me very great, since I need absolutely for my own kind of criticism of what I would call with Descartes a cogito. And there is no kind of cogito in the subconscious identification.
May I reply?
Please.
I would say that, again, talking on this purely empirical level, that you start with a conscious relationship with the book, as you saw it, sitting on a table, a separate object. Then again, consciously, you become more involved with it. And then you begin to respond along a scale of a very primitive level at the bottom, and then your cogito at the top.
And it is consciousness.
not at the bottom end.
Yes, at the bottom end also.
No, no, no. Well, of course, I don't know. You don't... Mr. Maxey says, would you believe pre-conscious?
I have a feeling that this may be a good time to stop while we're ahead and to declare this session closed, thanking Professor Poulet for a provocative, admirable paper and for the good-humored responses that he gave.